Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast, where I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My non-random guest tonight is Andy Anatko. Andy, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for asking me, Scott. I'm very, very pleased to have been non-randomly selected.
That is...
It really does smack like profiling.
Slightly.
But I'm gonna take you at your word that I was non-randomly selected for this special screening of this episode.
That's right. We rented out. This is the first time. Last couple episodes ago, I did the first in-person episode recording. This is the first episode in which, due to the majesty of the episode we're watching, I rented out a movie theater. I flew Andy into Philadelphia so we could watch this episode in the majesty that it deserves in one of the grand old theaters here in Philadelphia. And so now we can talk about it. None of that is true.
I just want to be on record that I was perfectly willing to back up your lie. This is your show. I'm a guest in your house.
Well, thank you, Andy. So why don't you tell the folks a little bit about yourself before we get on to more silliness?
The one-line thing I usually say if I want to convince people that I'm a somewhat professional at some sort of job is that I'm the Chicago Sun-Times technology columnist. But I write about and talk about technology in all kinds of different places and all kinds of different faces.
And you have a website, andyi.com, is that right?
That was my first big domain name success. I was just sniping on that domain name for years, just waiting for that person to forget and renew it. And boy, did I jump on it! But no, I decided to have a domain name that's even harder to spell, anatko.com.
Yeah. Ah, there you go.
For those of you who can't spell my last name, though, I've also taken cwob.com, which is also impossible to spell off of pronunciation, but it's easier to spell and shorter to spell on the air.
Just one of the many valuable services.
It's all about marketing. It's all about leveraging your brand across the social graph, Scott.
That's true. I need to start doing that because I need some friends. But let's talk. One of the reasons I don't have friends? My obsession with Star Trek. So let's talk a little bit about your thoughts about Star Trek. Now, I have been reading your technology columns for a long time and following your career. We appear on the Incomparable sometimes together. So I know that you have many, let's call them geeky interests, but I have no idea if Star Trek is one of them.
Well, not really. My generation was the one that got introduced to Star Trek with The Next Generation, mm-hmm. and I like that series a lot. I think that that's what taught me about the healthiest relationship to have with Star Trek is to accept that there's going to be... if there's 100 episodes, there's going to be 20 that you like, 5 that you absolutely love, 20 that are embarrassment, 5 that are absolutely horrible, and the rest you can sort of give and take. And the key is to just burnish the memory of the really, really good ones in your mind, enjoy the rest, and even find some love in your heart for the 5 where it's like, okay, so everybody on the Enterprise is turning into animals, and 43 minutes later, everything's okay. Okay, that's fine. That's fine. You had a series contract. It's a season order. You got to fill out the season. By the time you get to the end of that week where you're picking scripts, you just want to go home. I understand that. I'm glad that somebody got paid for their spec script, and even if it does mean that Deanna Troi is now a frog for some reason.
Well, that made perfect sense in the context of that episode. No, it did not. Given that, then, so would you say that you could even pick a favorite series based on your interest in Star Trek?
Geez, I don't know. I would have to say The Next Generation. Maybe because that was all brand new to me. There's a lot of prejudice going on. The signature science fiction franchise when I was growing up was, of course, Star Wars and Hitchhiker's mm-hmm. Guide to the Galaxy. And even then, the Star Trek people realized that by the early 80s, these were people who had been hanging on to 2.5 seasons of 1960s television and one cartoon animated series and a really, really bad motion picture. And these people were often thought of as, wow, you guys are kind of weird. And because we had Star Wars, we had Han Solo, for heaven's sakes. You got Han Solo, you got lots of other people that are also really great in Star Wars, but I just could not find anything in the entire Star Wars canon, the Star Trek canon, that could compete with Han Solo and the Millennium Falcon. End of argument. And so that's why you sort of turned your back on it. And then after The Next Generation, you just had that old regime at Paramount that was so strictly committed to saying, well, we have let's draw a composite sketch of the person who was a fan of this TV show in the late 60s. Let's say they were 10 or 11 years old, you know, laying face down, laying you know, belly down on the living room carpet, looking up at the Magnavox or the Philco or whatever for that half hour, that hour every single week. How old are they right now? Right now they're 43. Great. Let's make sure that we make a version of Star Trek that will be very, very happy for this 43-year-old person who's done nothing but love Star Trek for 20 years, 20, 30 years to watch. And so that's why it kind of got hard to get into. It was so fusty. It was so cobweb strewn. It was so, we can't do anything fun or interesting with this because everybody, we've done everything right now, but explain why there are those little leather barbs on the Klingon uniform gloves. And now we have to explain that because there are people who are like, I must know why those things have, why is that there's that spiky thing on the outside of the boot. We haven't had a story about that. So let's have a story about that right now. And so the people can now argue about, well, I saw a fan, I read a fanfic in my zine in 1983 that explained it much, much better. I have to admit that I am the Star Trek fan of Marvel and DC Comics. I'm the person who's saying, let me tell you and explain why it was such a tragedy that Marvel saw fit to destroy the African nation of Wakanda. Here's the role that Wakanda had in the, like, okay, Andy, you've been reading Marvel Comics for 20 or 30 years now. It's time for the people who've been reading Marvel Comics for 2 or 3 years to have something that's really for them. Go spend that time in that room of your house that has nothing but long boxes with, you know, John Romita Sr. and early John Romita Jr. comics, and just leave it be for other people. And because every time that I start to think about that way about Marvel Comics, I think about how that's what kept me out of Star Trek. The fact that it was just such old stuff and such, oh, I don't care about any of this. You think this is fascinating, but this is really meaningless to me.
You're bringing me down, Andy.
That's what I'm here for. Again, and realize that, again, I was non-randomly selected, so this wasn't just simply an act of God. This was an act of Scott.
That is true.
Bringing me on to bring you down and all your listeners.
I take full responsibility.
I should back up and say, and I'm not criticizing anybody for liking the things that they like. A lot of people, I think, I imagine that one of the things you do like is, I would say, like the tradition, that it really is this 30- or 40-year-old franchise that has all this backstory to it.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I mean, you get to know, I mean, the thing about Star Wars, at least the first three movies, right, when you compare it to Star Trek.
The Holy Trinity.
That's right. We won't talk about any other movies. Is during that time period, there were just the three movies, right? So, and for a long time, there were just the three movies. And The Next Generation came out. And so Star Trek had this big, deep catalog of the original series, The Next Generation, a bunch of movies, so you got to know the characters so well. But like you said, the downfall to that is that with so many episodes and so many movies, and as this podcast proves, you're going to have some things that are not very great. But even then, you get to know the characters so well that you can find something to like about it. But you don't have like the tightness of the three movies, when you have this sprawling universe. And of course, Star Wars now has a sprawling universe, and they're dealing with a similar kind of situation. And I think Disney is trying to do something about it by, you know, culling the expanded universe. And Paramount has done with the J.J. Abrams reboots a similar thing with Star Trek with the new movies, right, where he basically just resets the whole thing.
Yeah, and I love the rebooted Star Trek, and part of it was that you have to deal with the fact that these are 60 and 70 and 80-year-old people who still have the rank of, like, lieutenant.
Right.
And it's like, oh, man. And even in the Next Generation, it's, why is Riker, like, still, like, second in command here? Why are all these people just sort of completely stuck in their careers? And I like the fact that by the end they were sort of nodding toward that by having these, was it the Best of Both Worlds? The two-parter that where Picard was assimilated by the Borg, where it's like one of the runners for like the part one was that, look, you're killing your career by turning down command offers.
And
only that, but now there are people who are younger than you who are going to say, hey, you're in my chair, Riker. I'm going to have to get you out of there so that I can be second in command of the Enterprise, so that 2 years later I can be the commander of my own ship.
Yeah, that is a good point. They did, you know, Riker, for whatever reason, wanted to continue serving with Picard. And in the movie, Sulu does become a captain eventually.
Yeah.
Everybody else does. Well, I guess Kirk becomes an admiral, and then he gets knocked back down to a captain for being Kirk. But
Sulu might be my favorite captain.
We'll see. That's a great question. So why is Sulu your favorite captain?
Chiefly because, okay, I understand. I appreciate that part of it is because we see so little of him being a captain. But in every single scene in Star Trek VI, he is acting the way that I've always wanted Kirk and I always wanted even Picard to act, which is that, look, I'm the there's a reason why on a ship, the captain of the ship is often referred to as the old man. Because he's the guy that you don't cross. He's the guy that if he says you do something, you don't say, sir, the emotions of the people on this ship are very stressed out by your recent command. I want to say Kiefer Sutherland.
But Christian Slater.
Thank you very much. When Christian Slater says, sir, that's a very odd, you heard me, mister. Like, okay, there you go. That's what you want for a captain to do. He is competent with a capital COM.
That is true. And oddly enough, this is a great segue because Star Trek VI, the episode we're talking about, which is Enterprise Season 1, no, Enterprise Season 2, Episode 19, Judgment, is, I imagine, in the writer's room of Enterprise, they said, hey, you guys remember Star Trek VI? And all the writers are like, yeah, that's pretty good. And the writers,
you'll,
like,
never guess what I just took out of the dumpsters outside. Will you believe they were going to throw away all of these props and sets? We could have name brand sodas in the break room for like a whole month with what we're going to save off of the stuff I took out of the dumpsters. We just got to write some sort of episode around the
around this Klingon courtroom. That's all we need, people.
Oh, yeah. Dude, and you got, like, the claw thing with the ball gavel. Oh, awesome. Oh, dude, I will train you so mad.
Yeah, this is a very strange episode. I mean, it's not a strange episode. It's just a strange concept for an episode. And it's like they said, let's take the, you know, it was interesting in the Star Trek VI because it had, Star Trek VI had a whole bunch of plot around this courtroom scene and the penal colony. Whereas they said, well, let's just take the courtroom scene and a little bit of the Rorapente scenes and just make an episode of it for no particular reason.
Yeah. And that's not terribly bad. That's leveraging some of the assets of having something like Star Trek or Star Wars, where you can say, just like 20 minutes ago, I made a joke about Kobayashi Maru. Mm-hmm. And it's like, because there is this mythos in place, all you have to do is say Kobayashi Maru and you've got 20 minutes worth of story that you don't need to explain. So when you say Rurapente, you don't have to say, oh my God, that's like that really, really horrible, horrible dilithium mine where they just send people to die really quickly, but to get things done for the Klingon Empire before they die. It's okay, but in retrospect, I guess they did actually spell out that, oh, people die there by 6 months to a year. But at least the people who are fans of the franchise know that, oh, okay, that's really, really bad stuff. That's not, you know, country club prison. That's you're definitely not going to have a good time there. Right.
That's not the nice Klingon prison.
That's not where the Klingon, you know, financial criminals go.
Yes. Bernie Madoff is not in that prison. See? Eh? Anybody? No, nothing. All right. Well, moving on. So, Enterprise. Did you watch any of Enterprise when it was on the TV?
I saw the first probably three or four episodes because because I wanted to see Sam Beckett in that role. Mm-hmm. I thought that he was very, very good in Quantum Leap. And I'm also, by that point in my Star Trek history, I was in my 20s. I can't remember when that series started up, but I was very much in my, oh man, I could enjoy Star Trek if only they did away with this, this, and this, which is why I was so excited about Voyager, for instance, because it was, oh my God, what I don't like about Star Trek is that it's all about rules and regulations and how, you know, everything gets reset at the end of it. Are you telling me they're going to do a whole series based on the fact that there's going to be there's going to be a Starfleet vessel that's completely cut off from the chain of command, and they have to be completely independent pretty much forever? If anything gets blown up or destroyed, they can't put into a star base and have it fixed. If they lose a crew member, they don't get to get another crew member to come on board. This is going to be awesome. And then, like, what was it, like 10 shows in where, oh my God, we blew up a shuttlecraft. That's okay. We'll replicate a new one.
Yes, I think I totally agree with you. I think that Voyager really lost that opportunity of being kind of the, in an ideal world, I would think that Voyager would have been much darker than it was.
Yeah, that's what I was looking forward to. The idea that here is early Starfleet. Was it even Starfleet at that point?
It was Starfleet, yeah.
Okay, it was still Starfleet. Mm-hmm. But the idea that you still have this very awkward organization that had not become this paramilitary system-spanning superpower. This was just a group of humans trying tentatively not to get suddenly aware that there are other people who are way, way better at spaceflight than they are, and they're going to have to start learning the lingo and the politics and the warfare of these people in order to defend Earth. And as this episode sort of proved, it really, okay, so once again, you just started taking scripts off the slush pile and changing character names around, and they didn't embrace what it was that made this a unique series.
It is true. And to get back to Scott Bakula, I'm a big fan of Scott Bakula, and I've said this before.
As most sensible people are.
Yes, and talking about Enterprise episodes on this very podcast, I've made the same statement that Scott Bakula, very charming man, at least on screen. He's played many charming roles. Quantum Leap, Murphy Brown, likable guy. I haven't watched the CSI that he's in, but I'm sure he's good. I don't know. But in this in Enterprise, either he or the producer, someone made the decision, why don't you just be kind of grumpy and really stiff? Because that'll be good. And so it's like a waste of Scott Bakula's charm, because he's not charming at all.
Yeah. I think that if I were to cook up my favorite a concept for a Star Trek series that would really communicate with me, it would be the idea that you never can get used to any one captain. One of my favorite episodes of The Next Generation was where Ronnie Cox had to take command of the Enterprise for two episodes, mm-hmm. because Picard and a couple others were on a deep cover away mission. And you see just this entirely different command structure, and it wasn't being set up to say, oh, well, any commander who is not like Picard is going to be a tyrant and a martinet, and he's going to like drive the ship into disaster. It's like, no, he just has a different style. He's a person who says, look, I'm not 100% okay with like having my psychologist empath ship on the bridge, but if you're going to sit in the bridge, you're going to be in a damn uniform. But that's it. You're free to go now. Goodbye.
And he also changes the hours of the crew that have to be on the bridge. He does a lot of things.
Just stuff like, again, that's where that line came from. Say, sir, everyone's very stressed out because of this chain of command. And just cutting her off and saying, these are all graduates of Starfleet Academy, and they have been posted to, they've been given an elite posting. They would not be there if they're not capable of simply accepting and adapting to a new position. Do you have anything else to tell me about? Real. Whereas Picard would be, you know what? Let's take the battle bridge. We'll convert it into a hot yoga studio, and we'll make sure that everybody has their chakras in line. Because I sure don't want to drift 2-3 meters closer to the neutral zone unless every one of these 1,000 crew members and civilians on board were completely on board with me. I realize that I'm just the titular captain of this ship, and I'm just here to make sure that
we're a family.
Also, Ronnie Cox, one of the greatest character actors of all time.
And he does a great job in Chain of Command. It's a fantastic pair of episodes. And so, Archer. Let's talk about Captain Archer, who, you know... So Enterprise is set 100 years before the original series, right? So everybody's trying to figure out what to deal with. And then technically, I suppose, in Star Trek lore, this episode, Judgment, has many firsts for Klingons. So it's the first use of pain sticks, first blood wine, the first that we hear of Targs.
I just realized that whoever wrote the script got to like steal like all of the firsts. Like, you know what, I'd like to be able to take credit for the invention of pain sticks. I know I'm writing a series that takes place 100 years before anybody else. You know what, I could invent the concept of Klingons to myself if I want to.
Well, that's, I was in Memory Alpha, which is a fantastic Star Trek wiki. It says that the writer of this episode just wanted to put as many Next Generation Klingon references as possible so that it could be the first official reference in Star Trek.
This might have been part of the problem of...
So he really Klingons it up.
right before everyone said, you know what, let's I've been... Rocky, I've been your manager for 12 years now. I'm throwing in the towel. I'm not going to let you fight this guy because this is just getting sad.
Yes. So the basic plot of this episode, before we go on, and it's pretty straightforward, there's no B story, or C story, there's hardly an A story, really. Captain Archer is on a Klingon planet, perhaps the homeworld of Klingon, we don't know, and he is on trial for helping rebels escape the Empire. And so there are a bunch of courtroom scenes where he's at a tribunal. There's a hostile prosecutor and an ineffectual defense attorney that's assigned to him who is kind of, you know, world weary. And he's just going through the motions. And it seems clear that Archer's being railroaded into the death sentence. And so they have some arguments. We find out that Archer apparently helped some alien vessel and took the people onto the Enterprise. And they were, unbeknownst to Archer, colonists who were absorbed into the Klingon Empire. So a Klingon ship shows up and demands their return. There's a battle or a little chase and then a kind of a battle. The Klingons lose. The Enterprise goes off. And now Archer has somehow been captured. It's never clear how he ends up on the Klingon planet. And he's being prosecuted for this. Archer gives his attorney a little pep talk. And then the attorney casts off these years of sadness that have ground him under the Klingon legal system and decides to once again be an attorney. He doesn't win the case, but he saves Archer's life because Archer's only sentenced to go to Rurapente. But then the attorney is like, that is also a death sentence because you only last 6 months to a year. And he has this lovely little monologue in the courtroom to which the tribunal or judge decides, you know what? You like Archer so much. Why don't you marry him? And also, you get to go to Rurapente. So everyone goes to Rurapente. They're on Rurapente for about 3 minutes. And then causing what is sure to be a giant diplomatic incident, Archer's crew breaks Archer out of the Klingon prison moon. That's the end of the episode. And the attorney decides not to go with him because one man can make a difference.
Yeah, see, there was something annoying about Star Trek that I was reminded of during this episode, and that's the racism that's kind of hard to escape in so many of these plot lines. You have this classic syndrome where there's a race of utter savages, but don't worry, the white guy is going to come in and stir some of them to say, here's why your primitive throwback civilization is a whole fraud, and here's why you should, I the white guy, I'm going to tell you exactly what to do. Thank you, white man. I never really thought of it that way before, but I have seen the light that's going to bring our civilization to salvation. I'm only but a tiny match lit in the middle of a wilderness, but a tiny match can create a large firestorm, blah, blah, blah. I'm always amazed that, and this happens so many times in The Next Generation, too. The episode where David Ogden Steers is a scientist in an alien race where they terminate at age 65, where they basically say they're not enough resources to survive, to support elderly people. So it's been our tradition for millennia that you live to 65 and you have this, you train the person who's going to take over your role in society. And at 65, you have this beautiful wedding-like ceremony in which you gather your friends and family around and you celebrate your life, and then you take poison, then you die. And it, thank God the crew of the Enterprise came down and said, "My God, David Ogden Stiers, not only were you awesome in MASH, but this is barbarism. Do you realize that you're close to the cusp of making the scientific discovery that's going to rescue your entire race? It's silly for you to kill yourself." And this guy, for the very first time, says, "You know what? That doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, I'm going to go back on thousands and thousands of years of tradition. Even though I've lived here all my life, I've known no other cultural legacy, but I'm going to rebel against this." It's like, imagine that aliens came down and said, "My God, you mean that you don't have three children and keep having babies till you have three and then kill and eat the one that you don't like them? That's barbaric." And then you, Scott, saying, "You know, that's such a good idea. I have four children. I'll eat like one and a third of them right now." That's what I mean when I talk about the racism in this. And it's white guy and alien, but it's the same thing. I couldn't help but maybe do the arrogant thing of rewriting it in my head that I just would have liked this so much more if, you know, Archer is in the cell and he hasn't met his attorney yet. And the guard says, "Oh, well, you're having an attorney appointed for you. So is he good?" And then the guy just laughs, saying, you're so screwed, man. You got crazy old Colas going to be defending you." And the payoff being that he is pretty much ostracized because he is this guy who is profoundly dissatisfied with what has been happening with Klingon culture over the past 30 years, that there is no more justice, and that he's known for making these really, to Klingons, ridiculous statements about how, no, we can't just kill people to say that we've killed somebody. We have to give somebody an actual trial. And don't you see the hypocrisy in our so-called justice system? And, you know, and he could really be that Southern, you know, white linen-suited lawyer saying, "No, you know, I might be just a simple little contra lawyer reading up on the moons of Rider 7, but there is one thing that I've always learned, and that is that if you're going to bake a Tarkov pie, you don't kill the Kaboff until he's inside the crust." And I do believe that this is what Commander Chorus is doing here. And it just feels false to say that he had he was not motivated to do anything about the justice system. I would love for him to have sort of to Archer's consternation and dismay. Imagine if Kolos had been sort of looking for his own Rosa Parks. Because Rosa Parks wasn't the first person to to act as a possible legal study against segregation. It was the people who wanted to fight this were looking for the right person they could use for so they can do the strongest case against it. And so, oh boy, here's the Klingons are trying to execute someone who righteously rescued people that had been abandoned by the Empire. This is somebody who had, on public record, saved Klingons way in many, many times in the past, who had sort of prevented this other captain in this incident from getting himself killed. Mm-hmm. This is the case that if I really want to go out with a bang, if I'm going to be sentenced to Rurupente, I want this to be I want to go out in this huge blaze of glory where 50 years from now, new lawyers in training will read the transcripts of this and be inspired on what to do. That would have been so much more powerful than, "I don't know. I mean, I got another 2 years until I get my 30 so I can go retire at three quarters pay and, you know, worry about a boat and everything." I mean, just...
Yeah, they don't really earn this sudden reversal because throughout the episode, Archer and Kolos, who is his his attorney basically, don't really get along. Kolos doesn't tell him anything about how the court works, and then things are going badly, and then Archer takes Kolos is in his cell, and Archer gives him this little pep talk that immediately makes Kolos think, "You know what?
Yeah,
you make a lot of good points."
But the great thing about this is that this is why I love any Klingon storylines, because is it possible to call these actors really big hams without being insulting? Because these are not these are not designed to be like subtle, nuanced characters. These are people who storm into the room and say, "You will be quiet, human." And for that, you want people who just started doing television like 3 years ago. They're used to being in 500-seat theaters with no artificial amplification. They are just – and I imagine that especially – given that so many of these the actors who play Klingons are like older Shakespearean actors, they must just love this to say that I don't have to necessarily plumb the depths of this. I can, if I just want to indulge this instinct to be much broader than I ever were, that is almost exactly going to be the right choice for this role.
Yes, that's what Klingons are. And the actor who plays Kolos has much experience being a Klingon because he's also the actor who plays Martok on Deep Space Nine. Which I don't understand why they keep going back to the same actors for different Klingons, but they probably thought, oh, wouldn't it be funny if we had a Deep Space Nine actor play Kolos? And he does a fine job as
That must be part of the fun, too. Whenever I see actor, there was an actor in Babylon 5 that he did such a good job. I think even he played a human the first time he guest starred, and then they liked him so much that they just kept bringing him back under different alien masks. And every time I see something like that, I always think that guy must be so much fun to work with in terms of just being pleasant on the – being really good on the set, really nice off the set. If they keep hiring you back time and time again, there must be something really special about this guy.
It's true, and that's the great flexibility that you have when you're putting, you know, crazy makeup on someone is that they can be several characters and it's okay. Like, you know, you can play Spock's father and you can also play the first Romulan that we've ever encountered. It's fine. And so speaking of sets, let's talk about the sets that are in this episode. There aren't that many of them. They want to keep costs down. So we get the bridge of the Enterprise, which, you know, they always have. And so it's nicely – I always thought the industrial design or set design of the Enterprise – in Enterprise was always appropriate because, you know, it's a weird kind of challenge, I imagine, for someone who's making a set like that because your show is set 100 years before a show that was filmed in the 60s.
Yeah, that's so that occurred to me too, where you have this needs to their Enterprise has to be the most primitive Enterprise we've ever seen. Mm-hmm. But because this was done when digital model making was in full bloom, it looks like the best, the most high tech, the most efficient, the best made Enterprise ever.
It does. And I was, obviously it's the most recent Star Trek. So of the series. So yeah, I was looking at the special effects and, you know, they have some shots of the Klingon ship and the Enterprise against this big planet and it all looks so beautiful. And it's hard to think, oh yeah, this is 100 years before the original series. But they do make all the knobs and things on the bridge are actually knobs and things. And they made the choice, I guess, of making the uniforms more military, like, you know, little jump, flight suits, instead of, you know, I guess, leisurey suits kind of things.
It's like this is 100 years in the past. They need pockets. Give them pockets.
Give them a lot of pockets. You never know what you
might
need.
They have keys to things. They still have money. Give them pockets.
That's right.
Some of them have pill problems. They need to have pockets to hide things in.
And then, of course, we get the classic Klingon bridge, which is dark and has lattices and dividers for no particular reason.
But see, one thing remains constant. The female members of the Klingon bridge still are not given garments that cover their cleavage.
No, they have...
Still has not occurred. The zipper technology beyond them, even in the days of the Enterprise D, in the original Enterprise, oh my God.
They are – yes, that was impressive.
I'm hoping that they can use the excuse, hey, look, we don't have the budget to build new uniform, new costumes because they've got like 80 dozen Klingon costumes in storage. Costumes. We just have to take one from storage and they only made, you know, chesticological revealing female Klingon costumes for the movies. We're stuck with this.
This is what we have.
Or at least give her a scarf. Like give her a scarf.
I don't know if I've ever seen a Klingon wearing a scarf. That would have been interesting.
One of those infinity scarves? That would be like a space thing.
It's true.
They could say that they could say that hey, look, when Klingon women reach the age of command, they are sent into the great swamps of Kha'Kha. They must slay a serpent of no less than like 18 feet, and then that is made, the skin is which they skin with their teeth and their hands is made into a ceremonial nice little wrap that keeps the chill away, and also, you know, tells the men on the bridge, yeah, see this? Killed it myself. That's right. Tore it apart with my teeth. All you had to do was like read some scripture, and then they let you be. You know, right. I had to earn this.
You prayed to Kaelas, and now you're
unless your hand is faster than this snake, I suggest you keep your mitts off.
It's brilliant. And then we get the Klingon courtroom, which is exactly like the Klingon courtroom in Star Trek VI, only less impressive, because it's obviously a TV set, I guess. So that's dark. So the Klingon ship bridge, super dark. The courtroom is dark, and all the Klingons in like the gallery have sticks that they just all pound on the floor. I don't know where they get these sticks. They must hand them out of the door when you come into the courtroom, I guess.
Maybe it's like bowling, where once you really get into this, that's the time you decide you want to buy your own stick instead of just renting.
Yeah, that's right. I don't want to rent I don't want to rent your cheap courtroom sticks. I have this one with my little leatherette case.
I don't care how many times you sprayed it with that special disinfectant stuff. I want to have my own custom stick.
That's right. I can still smell the targ on this stick, which is probably a good thing for Klingons. And then we get, of course, Archer's little cell is the other set. That's very dark and lit by torches. And there's a scene in that I wanted to talk about in the cell. At the very beginning, Dr. Phlox comes down to talk to Captain Archer. And he has this little clever there's a Klingon guard at the door. And then Dr. Phlox is like, oh, you are recovering nicely, but you're still infectious with, you know, whatever this disease.
I'm surprised they haven't put you in isolation.
Yes.
This is a very contagious disease.
And so the Klingon looks very worried, and he moves like 2 feet away so that they can then have this long conversation about how they might try to, you know, pop him out of the clink. And I'm thinking, the Klingon can clearly still hear you.
Yeah. I see that it was such a small move, I didn't even get immediately that, oh, this was just a ruse. And also remember that that's the cold open, mm-hmm. and he looks like he's had a rough night and he's unshaven. So I'm thinking, oh, so he is actually sick, I'm guessing, and probably unrelated to why he's in a jail cell, but okay, I accept that. Oh, then 20 minutes later, that was just a trick. Okay.
That was just a trick that then didn't do anything with. And that was ineffectual anyway, because the guy did not move that far, very far away.
Remember, this is like 100 years in the past relative to the first series. So the, hey, look over there with that thing that you dropped, that had not been invented yet.
That's right. They're working towards it. They have their best Starfleet scientists are working on that. And then the final set that we get are the dilithium mines of Rorapente, which are the most brightly lit sets of the entire show.
They spent a lot of money for that styrofoam packaging material. You want to show off where you put your effects budget.
I just found it so weird that you would think you're in like a moon hundreds of feet underground. And now might be the time when you want a little mood lighting, make it dark, make it look dangerous. But it's like they're in a Walmart. it's weird. And this
I'm trying to think about dilithium mines or spend that time in a Walmart.
It's equally difficult. I think you would not last 6 months if you had to stay in a Walmart. And then this is another – maybe Klingons have very poor hearing because, as I said in the brief synopsis, they you know, get Archer out by – they sneak in to Rorapente on a dilithium ship by bribing them. And Lieutenant Reed is disguised as a prisoner, and he walks up to Archer, and he's like, Captain, I'm here to rescue you. And there are like eight – there must be 18 guards within like 3 feet, and they just walk away, and they escape, and that's it.
I was kind of thrown by the ending of that because they really compress what almost should have been a whole Act 3 into an epilogue. Mm-hmm. And at least I do like the fact that instead of doing this entire here's the really complicated scenario in which we're going to get our own guy to break into Rurapente to get the captain out. It was, no, they're Klingons. We just bribe them.
Yeah, okay, makes sense.
That works. That absolutely works for me.
So, Andy, I think I might know the answer to this question, but what did you think of this episode overall?
Not highly, but I didn't think it was terrible. It was unfortunately, it really was just right there in the middle of the bandwidth. Mm-hmm. I thought that it took way too long to get started. I really thought you could have taken at least the first 20 to 30 minutes of it and compressed it down to 10 minutes. I really wanted to see more of Koros. I really wanted I think we're talking about a really powerful actor doing great things with a very, very light role. But it just really indicated that if the writer of this episode had been informed of who's going to play this and said, oh, I was going to hand in the script 3 days early because it really is finished, but now I'm going to rewrite this entire thing to make it just a showcase for this guy. I want Archer just to be the guy. Wait a minute. You're arguing with the judge who is about to sentence. Don't argue. Don't tell him that he's a fraud. And, oh, my God. I don't have a whole lot of options here. Can I have another attorney, please? It should be like my cousin Vinny, only like on the Klingon home world, where it's like you have this guy that seems like the least competent person ever, but he's actually the most perfect defense counsel you would want in this situation.
I would have preferred that episode, I think. I agree with your assessment that this is...
How do you say Utes in Klingon?
I'm sure that the internet will tell us.
or make a suggestion to your email.
That's right. Send your postcards to Rurapente, care of Scott McNulty. This is in that band, that troubling band of Star Trek episodes where it's just okay. It's kind of boring. It's middling. Not much to – I mean the most fun episodes, I've said this before, to talk about are the really bad episodes because you have lots of stuff to make fun of basically, or the really great episodes because they're really great. And this one is just kind of eh.
Yeah. I can remember Data's Day and I can remember the episode where everybody turned into animals. I can't remember the ones that Riker – gets busy on some planet and finds some plant that there's a misunderstanding about. It's like there's 100 of those and you just don't remember any of them.
Exactly. And this is one of, sadly, kind of par for the course for Enterprise, one of the non-memorable episodes. But this episode of Random Trek was memorable because you joined me, Andy, so thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I had a lot of fun talking about a show that I actually know very little about.
That's what I look for. That's why you were non-randomly selected, Andy. Next on Random Trek, Enterprise Season 1, Oasis.